Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, it's Super Tuesday, the most important day so far in the race for the White House. And we'll focus in on the contest in Texas. An analyst says the Iranian election does not necessarily represent a historic change for the nation. And we hear about controversy at the Academy Awards.
Ever since nominations were announced January 14th, the whole conversation's been about diversity. It's been about two straight years of all-white nominees in the acting categories.
It's right here on the Voice of America. Today is seen as crucial in the U.S. race for the White House on so-called Super Tuesday. Republican and Democratic candidates vie for their party nominations for the presidency in several states. Following the campaigning is correspondent Catherine Gibson, who joins us here in the studio today. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello.
Hi. Perhaps first off the bat, could you explain for our listeners just why this is such a decisive day?
Well, this is a very big day. Up until now, we've only seen a caucus or a primary vote in one single state each time. Today, we have votes across the United States, a diverse array of voters, caucuses, primaries, 12 different states. We really have a huge group of voters who are making their voices heard all on one single day. And that can mean a lot of momentum for the candidates.
In general, what has voter turnout been like so far?
Steady. We have some concerns about storms in some parts of the country that may impact voter turnout. So we'll have to monitor that and see how that impacts things.
Well, in the Republican camp, Donald Trump, bigger than life, Donald Trump still seems to be out in front.
This is going to be a big day for him. He's polling in 10 of the 11 states. The only state he might have trouble in is Texas. So, you know, we'll see. But a big day for him.
And there are only two remaining candidates in the Democratic race. Where do they stand today?
That's right. So Hillary Clinton has a lot of momentum after her win in South Carolina last week. She trounced Bernie Sanders there, particularly amongst African-American voters. That's a stronghold for her. And the demographics are very similar in the states that are seen voting today. So we expect her to do really, really well. The chance that Sanders does have is in white liberal states like Vermont, Massachusetts, Colorado, Minnesota, and those are the spots that he's been campaigning in the past few days. So look to see how he does there, and that may give some clues as to whether he stays in the race or not.
Well, nobody is really expecting Sanders, or Clinton for that matter, to drop out after this particular balloting period. But on the Republican side, there are five candidates, and two of them are not doing very well. They're not in the front running. Do you think we might see some of those people step aside?
I actually don't think we will, because we have Ohio Governor John Kasich in the race, and he's obviously waiting for voting in his home state, which comes later on in the month. He's going to hang on and see how he does there before he drops out of the race. Marco Rubio is waiting for his home state of Florida on March 15th. I think we're going to see a longer race, even though Donald Trump will do well today.
But this has been a very exciting campaign period this year.
That is for certain. It's been a mile a minute. Okay. Very interesting. You don't know what to expect
next. No, you
don't.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
You're very welcome.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you so much for having me.
Big day in U.S. politics.
Very big day. Hashtag Super Tuesday. Everybody's going to the polls, or many states are going to the polls, to vote in the presidential primary process. And social media is just lit up thus far, as it will be all through the rest of today and into tonight as the results start to come in. A lot of questions about who's going to win, who's going to do well, what candidates might drop out. There's a lot of speculation. It's almost like a mini election day. You see this kind of fervor on the actual election day in November. But this similar kind of fervor, similar kind of excitement, and similar speculation.
And where are we seeing it the most happening in social media? Is it Twitter? Is it Facebook? Is it what do you think?
I mostly see it on Twitter just because of the immediacy of Twitter. I think the big difference between Twitter and Facebook is that Facebook is more, you know, you post photos, videos. It's kind of more feature-y, if you will. Facebook is much more like news headlines, much more immediate. That's the place you go for breaking news. That's where I'll be looking tonight to see as results come in. In fact, results are now these days reported on Twitter before they're reported on TV or radio or anywhere else. So that's actually where not just the populace is looking, but journalists are looking as well, because that's where things are getting tweeted out from secretaries of state saying this many precincts are in, or we've declared this person the winner, or this exit poll. So it's really the immediacy of Twitter that's going to play a key role tonight.
And you've also talked about in previous shows, the candidates are using social media as well. Have you noticed any candidates are using Twitter and Facebook more than others?
I think Bernie Sanders has had really a lot of success because he has a very young base of support.
Hip.
Yes, very hip. Yes, so he's done a lot with Twitter. Donald Trump has done a lot with Twitter and Facebook. Hillary Clinton as well. She's tweeting out. I think at this point in the climate that we're in, you can't not do this. I think every single candidate that's in the race thus far, in fact, every candidate that's run there, I think there were 17 Republicans that started out and maybe four or five Democrats. Every single one had at least a Twitter and a Facebook page. In this climate, you really can't operate without those things because that's where so many of the voting public are. And you have such a loud voice that you can use. You tweet something out and you have millions of followers and it gets retweeted tens or hundreds of thousands of times. It's more effective potentially than any paid advertising that you could have.
And better than the news media or public appearances too, because your voice isn't just heard with the distance of a microphone. It's heard around the world.
You can multitask. You can be on the campaign trail, and this is what a lot of them do. You're on the campaign trail and you're tweeting and you're taking pictures and posting them to Facebook. So you're kind of killing two birds with one stone. You're out meeting with the people in person and you're talking to the people out on the internet.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of Dutch and American researchers have put a high-tech spin on the age-old art of fly fishing. The researchers have developed a new version of waders, those waterproof boots with pants used by fishermen to keep them dry as they wade through streams while fishing. These new high-tech waders have been equipped with temperature sensors to gather data that helps evaluate water quality and quantity. The wader sensors gauge water temperature and then sends the measurements via Bluetooth to an angler's GPS-equipped smartphone. According to the researchers, fishing enthusiasts would be able to immediately use this information to help them locate areas in the stream that are likely to have more fish. Meanwhile, the temperature data, along with the GPS-measured location, can be uploaded to the telephone where scientists can access it. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
One of the biggest states in the United States is Texas, down south on the Gulf of Mexico. It is of particular focus today on Super Tuesday because of the number of delegates at stake and the uncertainty over who might win in the Republican Party. Joining us on the line is Greg Flakes in Houston, Texas. Hey there, Greg.
Hello.
Hey, tell us, why is Texas getting so much attention?
Well, this is a really make-it-or-break-it state for Senator Ted Cruz. This is his home turf, and the polls do show him slightly ahead, although some of them show Trump coming pretty close. And so there's the chance that Trump might win, or at least come so close to Cruz in his home state that it would be somewhat embarrassing.
What is the political atmosphere there, would you say? A liberal, conservative, ready for change?
Well, I think the latter category would describe both parties in a way, because this is an unusual year in which you have a sort of insurgent candidate on the Democratic side, Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, and then on the Republican side, you have at least two or three people who have been seen as the outsiders, the outsider, the candidate who bases the campaign wholly on coming into Washington and just shaking everything up.
How does the state traditionally lean?
Well, in the case of the Republicans, the state has really become very conservative. The Tea Party groups, the various social conservative groups, tend to have a sort of a stranglehold on the Republican Party here, as is true in some other states, especially in the South.
And the polls today, are people going out and voting?
Yes, but keep in mind they've been voting for the last couple of weeks. We have early voting here. And that could figure into the results here as well, because people have been listening, for example, since the debate last Thursday. There's been a lot of back and forth and a lot of, very low-level rhetoric between some of the candidates. And whether or not that'll have an impact, I guess we'll find out. But many of the people have already voted or had even voted before the debate. So they may have already been set and determined in who they had chosen. So the late voters or the voters that are coming today may vote in a different direction. We'll have to see.
Well, thank you very much, Greg, for talking with us from down south.
Okay, it was nice to be with you.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Coming up on International Edition, a peek into the crystal ball to consider Iran's future, and controversy at the Oscars. Speaking today in Iran, President Hassan Rouhani, who presided over last year's international nuclear agreement, said voters choose the right and proper path for the country, a reference to election results from Friday's ballot for parliament and the assembly of experts. Reformists appear to have made significant gains in both bodies. Mr. Rouhani said the owners of the country are the people, and they determine its path and direction. With a voter participation rate of 62%, reformists may have tripled their presence in parliament and swept 15 of 16 seats from Tehran in the Assembly of Experts, where hardliners apparently have lost their dominance. 12 women were also elected. Dozens of seats remain to close, too close to call, and will likely result in runoff elections in April. Some analysts say the results could lead to greater contact with the West and greater foreign investment. But the Atlantic Council's Nabil Khoury tells VOA's Victor Beatty the election does not necessarily represent a historic change that will impact all of the Islamic Republic.
You may have technically a hung parliament because the reformers are said to have won roughly 28%, the conservatives or hardliners 22%. However, you have independents about 17%, and nobody knows exactly where their leanings are. There are also moderate conservatives who fall somewhere in between the hardliners and the reformers. So altogether, it's very hard to predict at this point. The reformers made very impressive gains, especially in the nation's capital, in Tehran. But whether they can sway the entire parliament on specific issues, I think you'd probably have to take it issue by issue. The other thing is that in the end of the day, other than the parliament, of course, you have the Council of Experts and the Guidance Council, and these are important institutions. You have the IRGC, which is not just a military outfit, but it's also a political and economic force in the country, and that is very conservative. And when all is said and done, the supreme leader, Khamenei, who, although old and somewhat ailing in health, is still the leader of the country and the most important decision maker, and he remains very conservative.
Some key conservative or hardline members of both bodies, the Assembly of Experts and Parliament, were voted out. There was, by one measure, more than 60% turnout in the vote. What was driving the voters to the polls? Was it the economy? Was it the hope for greater democracy?
Yes, the turnout was 62%. The polling I've seen shows that the economy is the most important thing on the minds of average Iranians. So especially if you go outside of Tehran. In Tehran itself, a lot of political issues are at play, and you can sort of look at hardliners and reformers and moderates. But outside, in the countryside, in the villages, people are mostly concerned about making a living, about having jobs, about agriculture. So I think the election certainly strengthened the hands of President Rouhani and the foreign minister, both of whom are in the reformers' camp. But they're going to have to prove themselves to the average Iranian on the economy.
Nabil Khoury says the results appear to be a vote of confidence in last year's nuclear deal, but Iranians must soon be able to enjoy the economic benefits that flow from that agreement. The New York Times editorialized today that Iran is far from a democracy, and hardliners maintain a firm grip on the courts, most of the economy, and security matters, and it remains a destabilizing factor in the Middle East. But it says by tapping into the desire of young people for economic growth, greater freedom, and an end to isolation, Mr. Rouhani is gradually reshaping the country's politics. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
You've heard of hybrid vehicles. Now comes hybrid plane. The UK-based budget airline EasyJet says it will begin trials of a passenger plane that uses a hydrogen fuel cell to taxi on the runway. Ian Davies is head of engineering with EasyJet.
We pulled together a kind of basic idea around, could we use a hydrogen fuel cell to power our aircraft now while they're on the ground?
EasyJet says it could save around 50,000 tons of carbon-producing fuel each year simply by using the hydrogen fuel cell prior to takeoff. Davies says the technology is already being used in vehicles like Toyota's Mirai.
We think we'll need around 150-kilowatt generator, which exists today in buses. And I thought, well, if we can power a car and a bus, surely we can power enough of the aircraft during the turnaround.
The hydrogen fuel cell will power motors in the plane's wheels, and the only waste product is water. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Movie fans were able to watch their favorite stars together Sunday at the annual Academy Awards ceremony at the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. The Oscars didn't do so well on television, with its lowest estimated viewership in the United States since 2008, about 34.3 million people. Still, there is a lot of buzz about the winners and some controversy, as we hear from International Business Times reporter Matthew Pressburg in Los Angeles and VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, the Academy Awards, the big takeaway is that, you know, diversity was the big issue. Ever since nominations were announced January 14th, the whole conversation's been about diversity. It's been about two straight years of all-white nominees in the acting categories. And with Chris Rock as the host, he was always going to address that early on. And his monologue was probably the highlight of the show. It was powerful. It was right to the point. It was funny. Some people thought he didn't hit the mark head-on. He shied away from some of the controversial issues. But I think, you know, it got a response. The crowd was excited. You know, people reacted to it. But the show kind of got away a little bit. Lady Gaga and the Vice President Joe Biden had a very powerful sexual assault presentation. But then we had sort of other pet issues come up. We had the director of The Big Short talking about, you know, how people shouldn't vote for somebody who takes money from Wall Street. We had Leonardo DiCaprio giving a big speech about climate change, which has been a pretty big conversation in Hollywood for, you know, 15, 20 years now. Very important issue, but it did seem like Chris Rock's powerful political message may have got away from him over the course of a show that ran about 4 hours.
The discussion about diversity included the groups that weren't being discussed. It was primarily about African Americans not being in the Oscars this year, but there were also discussions about Asians and others who also were not included.
And what was interesting was Chris Rock, one of his, you know, lowlights of the evening was when he made a joke about Asian children and accounting. It really didn't land, and it created kind of a furor on social media, where in the diversity Oscars, you know, an anti-Asian joke, I guess, was kind of the lowlight of the evening. So, you know, it really was. The Asian actors, the lack thereof, became a topic of conversation, and largely because of that joke.
And it was a huge evening for the Oscars on social media.
Oh, yeah. And not a great evening for the Oscars and the television ratings, but in social media, the conversation keeps getting bigger year after year. And especially with the political issues and with, a wide-open award ceremony where Spotlight and Underdog won Best Picture, yeah, it really did spark a lot of social media conversation.
Leonardo DiCaprio finally got his Oscar for Best Actor. I almost envisioned him going up on stage and just holding his hands out and saying, "I'm on top of the world," and walking off the stage.
Right. I mean, it was a long time coming, and people were joking that maybe the climate change speech was in his back pocket for 10 years, and he was always going to give it when he was the best actor. But yeah, I mean, he was the overwhelming betting favorite on this. Everybody kind of thought it was coming, the sentimental favorite. There weren't tons of memorable performances opposite him. Leo was kind of, it was always going to be his coronation. Nobody was really surprised he won. A lot of people are happy for him, but I guess if this is the toughest thing he's had to go through in his career, we should all be so lucky.
And, of course, and we mentioned Spotlight. Those of us who are in the media and journalists were rather partial to that film.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, journalists love the fact that Spotlight won, but then again, we are journalists.
It was a bit of a surprise for that, because I think a lot of people were thinking, well, you know, maybe The Revenant would come out at the end.
Yeah, it was. A lot of people thought The Revenant, you know, would kind of complete the Triple Crown, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Picture, but no, it was Spotlight. But also this year, what was kind of interesting to me was that, you know, 10 Best Picture nominees, but if you think back at 2015 in film, Star Wars, Jurassic World, Furious 7, and to a lesser extent, Creed and Straight Outta Compton were huge popular hits. And if you watch the award ceremony, they really, you know, it was as if they weren't even released. And so there weren't a lot of big fan favorite movies in that Best Picture category. Mad Max was probably the most popular award-winning choice by the general movie audience. But yeah, I mean, so it kind of did create that opportunity for an underdog film like Spotlight to go and take that trophy.
Well, we hand the Oscar for Best Reporting following the ceremony to International Business Times entertainment reporter Matthew Pressburg. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. And oh, by the way, we've been broadcasting from the studio here live on VOA Asia just for a few minutes. But if you want to see what the studio looks like live, come on by tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the key propaganda points ISIL uses to cozen converts to its cause is to claim that its so-called caliphate's expansion is inevitable. But recent ISIL setbacks in Iraq and in northeastern Syria, particularly in and near the strategically significant town of al-Shadadi, once again expose the hollowness of that claim. In the last few days, local Syrian defense forces, supported by the U.S.-led coalition, have reclaimed territory in an area that was a critical ISIL base and have continued to liberate the population from ISIL's grip. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said, "By encircling and taking this town, we're seeking to sever the last major northern artery between Raqqa and Mosul, and ultimately dissect the parent tumor into two parts, one in Iraq and the other in Syria." Thousands of local fighters were involved in the effort to drive out ISIL from al-Shadadi, said Brett McGurk, special presidential envoy for the global coalition to counter ISIL. They included Kurds, Sunni Arabs, Christians. Mr. McGurk used a metaphor to describe this, saying, "There's a lot of different groups that are kind of shards of wood that want to fight ISIL. It's our job to try to pull them together, not just in a bundle, but in a bat. And what you have going now towards Shadadi is a baseball bat." In a recent address, President Barack Obama emphasized that the fight against ISIL remains difficult and complex. But he noted that efforts to squeeze ISIL's core in Syria and Iraq have borne fruit. With the help of coalition training, equipment, and support, ISIL has now lost a series of key Iraqi towns and cities, more than 40% of what it once controlled in Iraq, including the city of Ramadi. Its leaders have been killed. Its oil infrastructure has been targeted in airstrikes, leading to a significant reduction in ISIL's oil production. Its cash storage sites have been destroyed, resulting in the slashing of salaries for ISIL fighters. Since the summer, ISIL has not had a single successful major offensive operation in either Syria or Iraq. In the end, the brutality of ISIL is no match for the yearning of millions who want to live in security and dignity, said President Obama. With allies and partners in the service of our dedicated personnel, we will destroy this barbaric terrorist organization and continue to stand with people across the region who seek a better and a safer future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.